Hello and welcome to another news episode of BFRR, our Bitcoin and Fiat Rock and Roll podcast that explores the intersection of traditional finance, digital assets, and digital currencies, and helps you understand how digital money and assets will evolve in the future. I'm co-host Michael, and today it's time for another news episode. Today we look back to the month of August and discuss key news in institutional blockchain. Today I'm joined by our co-host Jonas and a special guest, that is Nadine from Particula. Hi, you three.
Hi, Nadine.
Nadine, how about you introduce yourself briefly?
Thank you so much for having me and inviting me in your podcast. So great to be here. So yeah, as you said, I'm Nadine, one of the co-founders and CGO of Particula. So the G stands for growth. So it just means I'm heading everything around go-to-market, strategic initiatives. And therefore, I'm a lot about news and trends because, of course, I need to stay up to date what's going on in the market. And in general, Particula is, you can understand it like a Moody's for digital assets. So we are a rating provider, especially focused on asset-backed tokens, which are, of course, tokenized assets, but can be also stablecoin, which are backed by fiat or a money market fund or commodities like gold. And therefore, we are, analyzing and evaluating. And it's all about risks in these type of assets. Thank you for having me.
And I guess, Nadine, you're also kind of a vocal voice, let's say, on LinkedIn when it comes to tokenization news and everything, right? So it's really cool to have you also today, like for the first time with us in this podcast.
Yeah, and on email, I think I've got your newsletter. It comes in regularly and I enjoy reading it. And it informs even the news episode on my end.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I think what is maybe one thing here, what is really interesting, we started collecting news by the end of 2023. And I can remember back then that it was very easy to post everything because there were mainly, like I think in a month, there were maybe 15 news around tokenization. And nowadays, I really have to filter. And I think this is where you can notice, okay, the trends are going strong and the growth is also happening. It's not just a feeling.
Filtering is an excellent cue because that's what we did for this episode. We filtered a lot and we do cover actually three topics today. There is first a market overview. We look at the crypto market and the two largest crypto assets, Ethereum and Bitcoin. We also look at the evolution of US policy. The White House published a 168-page pro-crypto report explicitly condemning the Operation Choke Point 2.0. And ultimately, we cover what we refer to as a stablecoin explosion. Everyone's launching a stablecoin these days, and we got to talk about stablecoins in 2025. So let's get started. Let's look at the market.
Yeah, it was another interesting month on the crypto markets, actually a month with two all-time highs if we look at Bitcoin and Ethereum. But let's start with a general crypto market overview of the total market capitalization. So what we have seen is a slight increase basically in this month from really 3.9 trillion to between 3.9 and 4. So it was really just slightly, and there were some ups and downs. So we also reached an all-time high for the general crypto market capitalization at 4.2 trillion. And again, if we zoom out, I'm saying this very often in this podcast, that we are now kind of always between or around 4 trillion, which is crazy if you just think back one or two years ago. So I always, would like to raise that. If we go a little bit deeper into Bitcoin and Ethereum, so as said, we had two all-time highs in this month of August. So both for Bitcoin and for ETH and the whole Ethereum ecosystem. But generally, if we look into Bitcoin, it was, in terms of the price developments, basically, despite the all-time high, kind of pretty quiet, if you will. So we started the month with 118K. We ended with 112K, so a slight decrease of around 5%. But again, as mentioned, we also had 124K all-time high on August 14. And again, I'm still surprised that Bitcoin gets, as little attention as it currently does. So if you look into the media, if you look into Google Trends and others, we are reaching all-time high after all-time high. And still, it seems to be very silent. But maybe it's also the summer break could maybe also be one reason for that. If we then look into Ethereum, it was really a strong month. So while Bitcoin declined, as we said, Ethereum and Ether, once again, the price increased with a plus of around 20%. Beginning of the month was $3,800. Now it's, when we record this, 4,500. So as said, plus of 20%. And also another all-time high on August 24. And I guess that's particularly remarkable that we've seen, like, or if we put this into the context of the whole Ether price development, that we were last September, kind of below 2K. Now we are approaching 5K, which is just, a very, very strong rebound. And I would say a lot of this is also driven by some developments, in the United States, because here, once again, I know we say this every month, but a lot of interesting news and developments have occurred.
Yeah, Bitcoin might be a bit boring this month, but its dominance stays high. The high Bitcoin dominance, I think currently at around 75 to 78% reflects still the safe haven status within crypto. So even as the total market hit 4.2 trillion, I think investors still allocated the majority to Bitcoin, keeping to treat it as digital gold. And this narrative is just now understood. And therefore, Bitcoin has become a bit boring in that it just found its use case, its narrative. It remains dominant. But what should you report about Bitcoin now?
And the good thing is also here that boring is not necessarily a bad thing, right? So it just matured. It's kind of in the center of global financial markets. I mean, we discussed this also in previous episode. I think currently Bitcoin is measured like, or in types of market capitalization, the asset number 5 or 6 globally. That's just a very crazy development. And if it's here, it gets a little bit more boring. I guess that's not necessarily a bad thing, if you will. But yeah, let's maybe look a little bit deeper into what happened in the US. There were a lot of news coming once more from the White House, also from the Fed, from the SEC. And I guess that's really worthwhile to discuss.
Yeah, the US policy and regulation when it comes to blockchain is certainly the opposite of boring. Let me start with what might be the most comprehensive crypto policy document we've ever seen from a US administration. On July 30th, the White House released a 168-page report titled Strengthening American Leadership in Digital Financial Technology. It's a detailed roadmap comparing crypto to inventions like railroads and the internet. And the report explicitly calls for the US to, quote unquote, adopt a pro-innovation mindset toward digital assets and make crypto a, quote unquote, hallmark of the new American golden age. So that is super bullish. But here's what makes this particular significant for institutional players. It directly addresses the regulatory arbitrage we've been discussing in this podcast for years. So for example, the report calls for immediate federal level crypto trading enablement and explicitly pushes for the CFTC, so the sister regulator next to the SEC, for increasing oversight of the CFTC over much of the crypto market. And that's interesting because institutional players have long preferred the CFTC's more predictable, more principle-based approach over the SEC's enforcement by litigation strategy. Even more interesting, this report also directs the US tax authorities, called Internal Revenue Service or IRS, to ensure more fairness and predictability in crypto taxation. So that would address one of the biggest pain points for institutional adoption too in the US.
And I would really say, Michael, isn't this, I mean, it's again remarkable how bullish the sentiment is. And again, if we look back 2 or 3 years where we have had no clarity in the US and we had Operation a Choke Point that was really kind of against the crypto sector, it's a complete different tone. And is it, you know, would you agree with me saying that, I mean, Trump as a president, he really promised to make the US, I think he said, like a crypto capital of the world, that he's really delivering sharply on that, or is this too much?
In a way, I agree. He's certainly blockchain bullish and he promotes the technology and its adoption both for retail and institutional investors. My big concern is from what motivation. I think it's not his mere admiration or for the technology and its use for the wealth of the nation. I think from my perspective, it's just he included crypto as a component of his family business and therefore abuses the mandate and the role to enrich himself. So he's not crypto bullish because he wants Americans to be wealthy, but because he wants his family to be wealthy. And this is what concerns me.
I think it's a mix from my point of view. So I definitely agree that his family is participating there a lot and benefiting a lot. I think his son, Eric, right? He launched World Liberty Financial and so on. And I see them all the time in the news too. And I think it's also highly strategically in terms of the USA and how they want to be seen in capital markets. And I think they recognize that, you know, just to stay with stablecoins, for instance, that they are a big holder of US treasuries and that they can get maybe themselves more independent from other countries who are holding a lot of US treasuries. So I think it's from that point of view also a smart move to recognize that and see, okay, there's maybe a different strategic leverage which we can use. So we can get more independent there and are not dependent on any on China, for instance, to buy US treasuries or to hold them or whatsoever. I think this is very smart, and this is sometimes what I miss in Europe, right? Because it's an angle every currency or countries who are utilizing a specific currency could strategically think about. Yeah, but you're definitely right. They are benefiting a lot from that too.
Yeah, you know, I appreciate your more nuanced view on that. Certainly, the US and Trump better understand how to use blockchain to strengthen the power of the US dollar globally by means of using stablecoins to export the currency, for example. I agree with you there. Your more nuanced analysis is more on point than mine overstressing Trump's family business.
Yeah, and it's also a huge voter base. I mean, I can remember when he was in, I don't know the English word right, but before there were the votes, so to say, he was rallying across crypto conferences, being on stage, which was already very crazy to see that this is happening. And I think he really saw, okay, there's a big group which gets, you know, not what they want. and there is a big industry already behind those people. And there are a lot of investors who are interested in US assets, and especially the US citizens are, compared to Europeans, way more risk takers when it comes to investments. And I think the pressure combined with their voting power behind these people also, I think this is what they also recognize as a strategic advantage for the votes.
Now, there's a second major development, that is Trump's executive order on so-called 401k investments. He signed an order allowing crypto in retirement accounts. Let's go through the moon math that interestingly describes the potential effect of this. So roughly 70 million Americans contribute to these 401k retirement plans, funneling part of every paycheck, usually bi-weekly, into a collective $8 trillion US dollar pool. And if crypto were to capture just 1% of that, we'd be looking at about $80 billion US dollars in inflows. Of course, 1% is rather conservative in this model. Yeah, there is a reality check to this idea, though, because Fidelity has offered a Bitcoin option already since 2022 and services about 40% of the 401k market, 40% of that market. Yet the adoption of these Bitcoin options has been remarkably slow. One reason might be that employers have to opt in explicitly, and once opted in, they shoulder the fiduciary risk, and most employees would rather not deal with that liability. So this executive order directs the Labor Secretary to work with the Treasury Department and the regulator SEC on parallel regulatory changes. But the real question to me is whether this order meaningfully addresses this fiduciary risk concerns that have kept the adoption of crypto or Bitcoin in retirement plans low. Yeah,
yeah, I think it's generally another very positive development that it's now possible to use crypto in this 401k settings. Because as you said, Michael, and I really like the math or the moon math, how you mentioned it, that this can be super, super big. Because the thing is also, if you are subscribed, let's say subscribed once, these investments are going on, right? So similar when you have a stock index ETF, you can do this and pay into this every month, right? So this means if people are in there once with some allocation, this is, of course, a very sizable amount of money. But I guess also here we have seen with Fidelity that this takes a little bit longer. And also I guess my comment from the beginning may apply here, as people are not, I mean, we are still living in our bubble, right? So the average American doesn't care about Bitcoin, to be honest. And he or she reads some of the news, I would say currently, but doesn't really understand that. So if we come up in a setup where it's really coming mainstream, in a sense that people again Google afterwards, educate themselves on Bitcoin and think it's important, then I think we could really see this this hockey stick also in 401k subscriptions using Bitcoin. But it needs, again, more positive public perception as well. I guess this holds for all countries, but in this setup for the US. But if we have this, I guess this is really has a massive potential. And I think the moon math midterm is really not too unrealistic, if you ask me.
Yeah, with that, I move to some fascinating developments beyond the White House at the Fed and the SEC, starting with what I at least consider one of the most important speeches on financial privacy we've heard from a sitting SEC commissioner. That is Hester Peirce. She spoke at Stanford's Science of Blockchain conference, and her remarks were what I would call a manifesto for financial privacy rights. She delivered a critique of the third party doctrine and the Bank Secrecy Act surveillance apparatus. She pointed out that under current law, when you give information to a third party like your bank, you're legally assumed to have no expectation of privacy. And this doctrine, established in the 1970s for telephone records, actually now underpins our entire financial surveillance system. But here's what makes this particularly relevant for our audience, that is institutional blockchain. Peirce explicitly advocated for privacy protecting technologies, self-custody rights, and warned against requiring peer-to-peer transactions to include intermediaries just for surveillance purposes. She argued that, quote unquote, requiring an intermediary to step in the middle of peer-to-peer transactions would be antithetical to a free society. So I think Jonas has one or the other word to say about this, given his business on privacy conserving technologies.
Yeah, it's again really bullish, if I had to put this into one word. But yes, you're right, Michi. I mean, we cover the topic of privacy in this podcast kind of from day one. And some of you still might remember that also Alex and I, with a few co-authors, wrote a paper on how to bring privacy enhancing technologies into a world of digital money, particularly CBDC. So I really appreciate that a lot, coming from an SEC, acting as SEC commissioner, because often I have the feeling that, you know, it is a lot about law enforcement and anti-money laundering provisions. And I guess there is no doubt that we generally need them, right? We don't want people to launder money to finance terrorism. But often this comes at the expense of privacy, and there's no balance, because there is higher interest in getting this law enforcement done than in ensuring or maintaining privacy. So I think this is really a strong signal, and I would really hope to see more of this also in Europe. But the good thing is also that we from Europe often look in the US and then apply things. Of course, also with Trump, it's a little bit different, because often we look now at the US and say, oh, this is what's happening, so we are not doing this in Europe. But I hope that this has an effect to Europe, because for me, privacy is just a fundamental human right, and self-custody as well. And blockchain technology generally provides so many advantages in this setup. And I really hope that we can leverage this and bring this into our society, so that privacy is rather strengthened than, let's say, reduced in our society.
Yeah, and then ultimately, the Federal Reserve, or the Fed, has made equally interesting statements. Vice Chair for Supervision Michelle Bauman delivered remarks at the Wyoming Blockchain Symposium that represent a reversal from her predecessor, Michael Barr. Michelle Bauman actually suggested Fed staff should hold small amounts of cryptocurrency to understand how it works hands-on. Her exact quote from that speech is, quote unquote, "I certainly wouldn't trust someone to teach me to ski if they'd never put on skis." So far, staff has been prohibited to keep crypto, and now her statement is, well, mingle around with it so you learn and develop a view. Yeah, and beyond, more significantly than that, the Fed announced it is withdrawing its 22 and 23 crypto supervision guidance and ending its novel activities oversight program that subjected crypto firms to rather enhanced supervision. So Bauman explicitly acknowledged that past policies of the Fed contributed to debanking and said regulators must allow and encourage banks to provide banking products and services to any legal business, including crypto, without disfavoring any particular viewpoints, businesses, or industries. Yeah, and ultimately, to finalize our US coverage, there's a development about traditional banking's concerns regarding stablecoins. The Bank Policy Institute, along with major banking associations, sent a letter to Congress using them to close what they call a loophole in the Genius Act. And here's the issue. The Genius Act prohibits stablecoin issuers from directly paying interest or yield on stablecoins, but it doesn't explicitly ban affiliate companies like crypto exchanges from offering yields to stablecoin holders. So, for example, this means Circle cannot directly pay yield on USDC, but Coinbase or Kraken can offer yield programs for USDC holders. Yeah, and this banking lobby here wants this could trigger 6.6 trillion in deposit outflows from traditional banks, citing a Treasury report. And they argue this threatens the credit system because stablecoins don't fund loans like bank deposits do. They are just digital dollars backed by safe assets. Yeah, so from the US, we see pushes from the White House, from the Fed, from the SEC, and from the banking lobby to close the stablecoin yield loophole and its controversy about it. And with that, let's move on to our stablecoin coverage about 2025 as the year of stablecoins.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Michael. Maybe just one last comment on the previous section in the US, because I know that a lot of also European policymakers are listening to this podcast. So really like kind of sending the clear message that there is a lot happening in the US. And also you can, you know, really don't want to be political here. There are a lot of things that don't make sense. There are a lot of things that might make sense. So really to just neutrally look into the development that are happening around digital money, digital assets in the US, as we said, you know, topic of privacy, also the retirement plans, the pro-innovation approach. So really to very closely look into that, and to not, you know, from the beginning say, look, this is happening in the US. We don't like generally where this is heading, so we are not doing it, right? So we have to disentangle a little bit the political setup, the political messages, and what's happening in crypto and Web3 from my side. So I would really kind of, yeah, put this message out to really look into this neutrally and see what one can apply to Europe, because my feeling is also if we don't act at all, we are lost, because the US will take over, I don't know, 98% of the market. So yeah, I know I'm normally not that clear, but I would really like to stress that message. All right, but going into stablecoins, so 2025, no doubt the year of stablecoins. And I know that even I'm saying this in every news episode when we talk about stablecoins, that was another bullish month on stablecoins. But if we generally look to the picture, what the status quo is, where we currently stand, it's basically a status quo, but that the market capitalization of stablecoins increased to approximately $280 billion from $200 billion in the beginning of the year, and basically almost a 100%, 50% increase. So from 200 to 280, and we have seen that there is regulatory clarity in the EU, because MiCA is fully into force and the US passed the Genius Act, right? So it's really legal certainty is at least getting way better, and a lot of things are clear here. And we have also seen that there are stablecoin projects kind of everywhere. So everybody talks about stablecoins. For example, payment service providers see stablecoins as a key priority in their strategy, to add a few company names: MasterCard, Visa, PayPal, Stripe. So basically all kind of major PSPs, if you will. Also commerce player explore the issuance of stablecoins, here to mention Walmart and Amazon, for example. Then we have seen that JP Morgan, the largest bank basically in the Western Hemisphere, launched some kind of a stablecoin-like token. It's, I mean, kind of rather a deposit token on a permissionless blockchain, but it's very similar to a stablecoin. Circle has conducted a successful IPO. AllUnity got the license and did the go-live here, regulated out of Germany. So there's a lot of going on, and there are really a lot of stablecoins out there. But still, every month, we see new announcements for players that want to enter the stablecoin market or want to launch their own stablecoins. So in August, for example, we have heard that MetaMask, the leading kind of wallet provider, if you will, in Web3 and crypto land, wants to launch stablecoin. We've also seen that the state of Wyoming, so a public state, launched a stablecoin. We've heard that in Asia, yuan-backed stablecoins are kind of legitimized and might come, adding another level of competition. Also, yen-backed stablecoins that launched in Japan. So you see stablecoins everywhere. And what I'm really asking myself, or I would like to ask you, Nadine and Mike, is do we need all these stablecoins? So we have so many out there. Still every month, new players enter the race, probably because they think we can do this better. We can earn a lot of money with this, right? The business case for a stablecoin is often very profitable, but do we need all of them?
Very good summarized. So it's actually a really good timing for me to be here because we were doing a lot of market research, market sounding the last few weeks because we got many requests from the US, especially from banks and other institutions from the US who asked us about, hey, we are thinking about launching our own stablecoin, or we are thinking of doing that and that in stablecoins. And what do you think about internal risk procedures, risk management? Because, of course, with the technical component, things are changing on that level too. And we were really digging into the market, figuring out, okay, we have one methodology which assesses, of course, specifically tokenized assets. We did tokenized bonds, tokenized funds, tokenized gold, and so on. But stablecoin is a bit different from in terms of the use case, of course, compared to tokenized assets where you invest because it's an investment product, and the stablecoin you want maybe use for specific use cases or for payment situations. And we spoke to the market and asked specifically what is important for you when you do the due diligence, how do you see the developments right now, and so on and so forth. And by the way, in this process, I also spoke to a startup based in UK launching a British pound-backed stablecoin. They also were just waiting for the license, which comes probably in the next 2 months. So I think every country is also, or in every country or every currency, they are launching stablecoins too. And even though it feels like everybody just wants to have a piece of the pie, I think it totally makes sense to find a way now to get into it and also to think, okay, how can we secure our spot in the market, or how can we secure our market share? Because if you look at MetaMask, for instance, right, they didn't have their own stablecoin. Now people are asking, why do they have to have their own? Why they're not still or continue to using USDC? This is correct. But in the end, if you are the infrastructure provider, you have the power and you want to have your own currency, basically, because this is where you make more money. And from their point of view, it was like, hey, why should we use USDC? We are not earning, it's not our coin, but when you have our own, we earn more. And I think this is what I'm seeing right now, that issuers of coins, of assets, even tokenized assets too. This we've seen that with Ondo Markets, for instance. Ondo, I think, is the most best example here, or Superstate with OpenBell. They're either launching their own infrastructure for their assets to get a better market position, or the infrastructure is launching their own coin. And I think it's a smart move, but we will also see in the next 1-2 years a lot of consolidation happening, right? Because not everybody will survive. And especially the ones who have the infrastructure now already really well established have a really big advantage, because infrastructure is power.
Consolidation is a really good cue, because my opinion is that the stablecoin market is heading for consolidation and not fragmentation. So while at the moment we observe fragmentation, I mean, at least it appears that ever more organizations or entities launch stablecoins, we would assume that the market increasingly fragments. But I think the stablecoin market is heading for consolidation. So despite everyone launching stablecoins, it's the network effects in that business and regulatory modes that will create a winner takes most, not a winner takes all, but winner takes most scenario within each jurisdiction. And one supporting point is that profitability attracts the giants, usually, who can then subsidize adoption. So companies like PayPal and Stripe can afford to operate at losses initially to capture market share, crushing smaller players in the market. Or another supporting point for my view is that MetaMask's 30 million users create instant distribution advantages. So launching the MUS dollar, so it's stablecoin, with a built-in wallet integration and MasterCard spending gives MetaMask massive head start over competitors. These are just two of many reasons why the stable market coin is heading for consolidation.
Yeah, and I mean, it's definitely a network effect game, right? So if you have a stable coin, but you cannot use it, you cannot off-ramp it, what's the point, right? So the larger the network, the better kind of for everybody. So of course, the better the business case, because you have more transactions or more stable coins issued, so you get more income. But also as an end user, you can use it for more. But of course, also one issue is before maybe, Michael, we have the phase of a consolidation there. The more stable coins we have, the more complex it is for the end users, right? So if I'm now in the future going into my, checking websites or maybe my wallet for stable coins, and there are already 10 US dollar stable coins in there, as a user who's not maybe as knowledgeable as we are on the stablecoin domain, which one to choose, right? So it also adds a lot of complexity from a user experience side, which is always a challenge in Web3 and crypto land, right? If you have more stablecoins.
And also from my point of view, which I think is very interesting to see and which makes it also very difficult to assess when you have different regulatory frameworks. You have the Genius Act in US, you have the MiCA here in Europe, you have other jurisdictions which are far progress, like Hong Kong. I was just reading into that too, who compared to the others clearly defined in very, very much detail what the technical implementation should look like compared to Genius Act, which leaves a lot open, right? And from my point of view, as somebody who evaluates those assets, makes it sometimes very tricky because there are best practices in terms of like token standards and what should be implemented in the smart contract, right? And you have with MiCA, where you say, oh, you need to have a freezing function and pausing function in the smart contract, and then you have your other jurisdiction where it's not mentioning. So you have a lot of differences here. And I think when it comes to especially payment structure, we should have one standard, because then it makes it easier also globally to trade, right? Otherwise, they are stuck again in these geography silos, which makes it very, very hard then to get to maybe a bank sitting in the US or in Hong Kong.
Yes, yeah, standardization and also like global, let's say, settlement or convertibility are super important. And here, which just like to mention, like we had one podcast episode with Tony McLaughlin from Ubix, who's basically building some kind of a stablecoin settlement engine globally. So it also needs this type of things, that you don't have just these separate stablecoins, but you can directly, easily swap the one into the other all kind of infrastructure. So that's definitely also needed, I think, for this development.
Yeah, but here again, interoperability reducing switching costs temporarily. So while multiple stablecoins can coexist technically, users will ultimately gravitate toward the most liquid and widely accepted stablecoin option. So I think in the current fragmented setup, this interoperability is super important, but the end game is liquidity and global acceptance of any given stablecoin.
So you would then say, Mark, it's really a winner takes it all thing? So that after the consolidation, how many stablecoins do you think we have?
Winner takes most, I would say, not winner takes all. So I don't think we will end up in a scenario where we have one global stablecoin issuer who kind of offers the one digital money for the planet. Which, by the way, might be a reason why Libra or Diem back then had such a hard time, because that was kind of their vision, in my interpretation. I think the end game is probably then per country, per continent, per currency, you see one or two players evolve and dominate.
I think also just through jumping in here, we are just talking right now mostly about stablecoins backed by fiat, which I think is really straightforward. But then you have the yield-bearing stable coins who sometimes have baskets of different assets. We just were talking to a project who are launching a stable coin backed by tokenized money market funds. And they were asking like, hey, what should how are they eligible to be backed by our stablecoin? And how can we create a framework which is selecting the right tokenized money market funds so they can be backed by our stablecoin? So I think this is interesting to see, and also to see how many of those we will have, because I think the currency, of course, we do not need thousands US backed, fiat backed stable coins. But when it comes to the yield bearing, like how many do we need from that? And, is it about utility? Is it about then demand driven? Who said, oh, I only want this type of coin, which is backed by gold or by a basket of different assets. So it's, it's interesting to watch.
Yeah, that's very important that the stablecoins are all different, right? And also serve different needs. So I would agree that, Michael, in the end, I would also see a similar endgame as you do, that we do have maybe a handful or less of you know, stablecoins in the jurisdiction, at least like in a similar setup. So I mean, you know, like fiat backed on similar blockchains, right? So this kind of setup, because I think generally it needs different stablecoins. So if you think about, and you mentioned this, Nadine, there are different underlying assets. So this can be fiat currencies, euro dollar, this can be crypto, this can be tokenized money mass market funds. As you said, this can be precious metals, this can be real estate, like anything, right? Can be behind the stablecoins. For fiat backed stablecoins, they are backed by different currencies, right? Euro, US dollar, British pound, Swiss franc, whatever. So also if you are in Switzerland, the US dollar stablecoin for a lot of use cases doesn't help you, right? So you need different currencies on chain, if you will. You also need the stablecoins on different blockchains, right? So also here, you know, there are different, there are a variety is required. You have also different use cases, different target audiences. There are some use cases that focus on B2B, some focus on B2C, some might even focus to B2G. So when it comes to government government payments, also if you not just think about business, of course, this can also be like initiated, and this is a core focus, of course, from customers. And they also can also serve different use cases here, right? So I think it really needs a variety there generally. Also, I think it's, if you think, you know, if you do this assessment kind of from an economical assessment, it's generally good also for competition if you don't just have one product, because in the end you are here in a monopoly, or if you have a few in a duopoly, which in the end makes the leading party to kind of set the prices, right? So that also the costs are maybe higher, and some people suffer, if you will. So I think that's also like an economical argument to have competition in the stablecoin world as well.
I think an interesting force in this debate over consolidation or fragmentation is now the emergence of state actors. I mean, at least in August, we saw the state of Wyoming targeting a stablecoins, and then even yuan-backed stablecoins. So China State Council targets or discusses to approve a new yuan internationalization plan later this month. And I mean, so far in the very short history of stablecoins, we primarily looked at it from a private sector perspective. So it's USDT, USDC, all private sector companies doing big business there. But now with state actors or public actors entering the space, there's a whole new dynamic in the consolidation or fragmentation of stablecoins globally.
And that was very interesting for me to see that even after so many years of stablecoins, like new stablecoin products come to market. And you mentioned Wyoming, and I think that's also a one of the most interesting recent initiatives on stablecoins, because it's kind of the first US state to issue a stablecoin. It launched on 7 blockchains, so directly going into a few of the ones. And the goal, and that's, I think, the key differentiator, is improve or increase efficiency in governance processes. So, for example, paying vendors in seconds, enabling tax refunds, social benefits, all on-chain. And the income basically comes into the state pocket of the state of Wyoming, which, for example, goes into a fund that in the end supports schools financially, right? So it's a complete different use case. It's not about cross-border payments, not about setting digital assets. It's basically about efficiency in the public sector, right? And yeah, I was really surprised to even see in 2025 a lot of novelty also coming to the stablecoin space through initiatives like this one.
Can you imagine that happening in a German state?
I was exactly thinking about
the Brezel stablecoin.
Yeah, let's pitch this to some authorities, but yes. Not too sure, to be honest.
I think they have to work also on digitalization in general. It's probably the first step. Let's get digital and then let's get a coin.
Exactly. Let's do it. Yeah, but I mean, maybe to round this up, so we do see, and I guess it's kind of the agreement that we are having in this round, that there are a lot of stablecoins out there that for a lot of reasons, you know, and people enter the space because, as you said, Mark, in the beginning, you can also operate this at a loss if you are a large company. But that, I mean, at least from our perspective, we think that in the end, this will consolidate, not maybe to one per jurisdiction and blockchain or use case, but to a few of them. But again, still interesting that we do see new stablecoins like Wyoming coming out that serves just completely new use cases compared to the existing stablecoins.
Yeah, so certainly 2025 is a or even the year of stablecoins. We've so far discussed news on the asset and application layer of stablecoins, but even on the infrastructure layer, so on the very bottom layer of making this whole digital economy or digital assets economy run, even on that layer, we have stablecoin news. That is, Circle just announced Arc, a new EVM-compatible layer one blockchain that is purpose-built specifically for stablecoins. This represents a rethinking of how blockchain infrastructure should serve institutional finance. So what makes Arc genuinely different starts with USDC as the native gas token of that blockchain. Enterprises no longer need to hold volatile crypto assets just to pay transaction fees, but these enterprise or these companies' treasury teams can operate entirely in dollar-denominated terms, eliminating one of the biggest operational barriers to enterprise blockchain adoption. And Circle built an integrated FX engine directly into the protocol layer, so an institutional-grade request-for-quote system enabling 24/7 peer-to-peer settlement between stablecoin pairs. So this is some of the core innovation that happens here. The technical foundation delivers sub-second finality, and Circle acquired a dedicated team for this and IP from Informal System, which is known for Byzantine fault tolerance research, and Arc also includes opt-in privacy controls so its users can selectively shield transactions while maintaining enterprise-wide compliance needs. So I just scratched on some of the core innovations here because, I mean, when you launch a new blockchain, you're obviously interested in what's the nature, the scope of that very blockchain. What I find even more interesting is here the timeline, because the timeline for this blockchain is aggressive. The private testnet is launching soon. The public testnet is expected later in fall. The main beta is expected for 2026. And strategically, Circle maintains full platform integration across services, that is CPN, CCTP, the gateway, and other blockchain services here. Importantly, Circle isn't abandoning their multi-chain approach. So Arc maintains interoperability with the existing 24 networks that support USDC at the moment. So they are not fragmenting the liquidity. They are creating specialized infrastructure with that Arc blockchain and still preserve their network effects. And that's so important because, as we understood in the discussion above or before, network effects are vital in the blockchain and the stablecoin business.
So we discussed before if we need all these stablecoins. Now we can discuss, do we all need all these blockchains? A question to you, Mike, like, you know, what do you think? What's like, if I got this correct, the USP is really that this is built for stablecoins, right? Is the USP actually so large that this can have success? What's your feeling on that?
Yeah, I mean, my first reaction or intuition was also that, come on, yet another blockchain. There are so many blockchains. They all have their already dedicated narratives, use cases, and aren't we already kind of messy, so mutually exclusive, collectively exhaustive in the set of blockchains that are available? But what happens here with Arc fits a broader blockchain race, if you will. So Stripe is building Tempo with Paradigm. Robinhood is launching their layer 2. Shopify integrating Base. So major companies are building their own networks rather than just using existing ones. Circle positions this as becoming a full stack internet financial system provider. So my take is that Circle is making a strategic bet that the future of institutional finance runs on stablecoin native infrastructure rather than general purpose blockchains like Ethereum. And the key question is whether this represents genuine innovation or dangerous fragmentation for the institutional adoption of blockchain.
I think really, really good points here, right? And I already answered that also a little bit when we were talking about the coin situation. Again, infrastructure is power, right? And I think it's a very smart move, and they definitely planned it for a while. That's why you have such an aggressive timeline, because I think they're probably building on that probably for a longer time than the public know. And it's apparently a really nice timing for them. Maybe they were waiting for the right timing. I think it's not a coincidence that the Genius Act and everything was moving forward, and then now all these stablecoin announcements are happening right away. I think a lot of people had already information probably a little bit a while ago, and get prepared for that, especially in America also. And yeah, again, when MetaMask is launching their own coin, because they do not want people or they want people to use more their own coin and not a UCC, then of course UCC is like, how can we secure our power when we are launching our own infrastructure? Of course, we can do that long term. And there are different now infrastructures using a specific purpose. And I think it makes sense, because thinking about creating a blockchain ecosystem which is really able to hold all the traffic of capital markets, if you would switch right away, right now at this point, there is no blockchain ecosystem, in my opinion, who could handle that, to be honest. And that's why I feel like everybody is trying to solve a specific issue and serving a different use case. That's why we have also now multiple RWA-focused chains, because they say, oh, an RWA, which stands for reward assets. I don't like to call it that way. That's why I always speak of tokenized assets, tokenized financial assets, for instance. They, of course, are different build compared maybe to DeFi applications or crypto in general. And I think we will see a blockchain ecosystem for every use case. I also just talked to somebody who's building on a network with a focus on trade finance, because there are also a lot of issues which cannot be solved right now with current infrastructure. So he's building something purpose-built for trade finance, because he's seeing that there is a demand and a need. And it will be interesting to see in the future how this is consolidating. Or are we really living in this multiverse of different blockchain ecosystems merging into each other, solving different layers of issues? Or do we have a super blockchain at some point which covers everything?
Yeah, and Circle's ARK strategy shows that vertical integration is really the trend. And vertical integration is just another term for what you, Nadine, just referred to as the super blockchain. So Circle and other big players, rather than competing on existing infrastructure, winners will build their own purpose-built system, which raises the barriers for newcomers. So it's really at least the attempt by Circle to own the full stack of the digital asset services, or of the future financial system, if you will. Because if you own the whole stack, you are a more powerful a player, and you raise barriers for newcomers. Yeah. So I liked your statement on infrastructure is power. And this is exactly the power Circle is looking here with ARK. In that instance, specifically for stablecoins. Excellent. So yeah, it's super interesting to see what happens in the stablecoin space. Too bad Alex could not make it today with the All Unity project, always offering an excellent perspective, in particular when it comes to the European view on stablecoins. We brought some interesting knowledge bites for you this month too. Mine is a New York Times article on this crypto report, this 168-pager by the White House. Yeah, if you don't have the time to read through 168 pages, which most likely you don't have, read this New York Times article. It's pretty nuanced, balanced in talking about it, and offers the broader perspective of what's going on in the US.
Nice. I brought today, Michael, a short article or paper as well, but focusing on a different aspect, namely cash. So it's an article from some European Central Bank economists that looked into some numbers on cash usage. And this was very interesting, actually, because you always read that the cash usage is basically in decline. But what they have basically seen is that mostly pronounced that young people are kind of reusing cash again, which I thought is very interesting. So it's primarily not for payment, but as a store of value driven by COVID. But I don't want to spoil too much here. I thought a very interesting article also because I'm a little bit biased because I am still a big proponent of cash, as most of you listening to this podcast know. But a little bit of another article, let's say, in this dimension of payments, not on crypto, but on general payments and cash.
Nice. My bite is actually also an article, but not as long as probably Michi's one. So if you don't have that much time, you can look into my bite because it's in general called Blockchains for TradFi, what banks, asset managers, and fintechs should know. And if you have a TradFi colleague where you feel like this person should know more about use cases of blockchain, this is a really well-written article by A16Z. And it's not superficial. It's sometimes going a little bit deeper, which I like. It's very well-written and really explains, okay, what are the specific use cases for a bank compared to an asset manager and to a fintech? And they're certainly also different. If you have somebody who you feel like should be more educated, send it to them.
Very nice, Nadine. So you just handed me the orange pill I can give to my SAP colleagues and to several Swiss banks that yet need the orange pill to swallow. All right. Thanks for listening to Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll. Thanks, Nadine and Jonas, for your takes and insights. Connect with us on YouTube, LinkedIn and our expert community on Telegram, both in German and English. For details, consult the show notes. Do visit our website for detailed analysis and detailed show notes, and make sure to subscribe to Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll wherever you get your podcasts, and join us next week when we'll be exploring another critical development in the evolution of digital finance. Until then, this is Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll, bringing Europe's perspective on digital currencies to the world. Thanks for listening.
Nice.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.